Welcome to episode 2 of Academics Talk About the Chair. I'm Inga Mewburn, a professor at the Australian National University and editor of the Thesis Whisperer blog. It's early September 2021 and literally half of Australia is still in lockdown, having the pandemic experience the rest of the world had last year. It's fair to say we're all losing it, just a little bit. Since we're all trapped in our homes, we're watching a lot of Netflix, and we've all been watching The Chair, one of the only shows to ever dare depict contemporary academic working life on the screen. We are 4 white female academics, and we loved it. We have so many thoughts and feelings about The Chair, and this podcast is our excuse to talk about it together and with you. In Academics Talk About the Chair, we take our cue from projects like Doctors Watch Grey's Anatomy. We're comparing our lived experience and knowledge of what it's like to work as an academic with a fictional account on the screen. We'll do a recap with all the spoilers. Then we'll talk about what's real, what's not, the best lines, and most importantly, the outfits. But first, some introductions.
Hi, I'm Narelle Lemon. I'm an Associate Professor in Education at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne. I write and blog about wellbeing and self-care at exploreandcreateco.com.
Hi, I'm Megan McPherson. I'm a precariously employed artist researcher and educator in art and intercultural research, and I work at the University of Melbourne.
Hi, I'm Anicha. I'm the former co-chair of the School of Graphic Design at a private art and design university in San Francisco, and I'm now professional staff, head of course design at RMIT Online. Yes, my voice is the same as Inga because we are identical twins. Our parents can't tell us apart, like for real. So Inga asked me to find another little story to illustrate. And we used to live together in a flat pre-cell phones because we're of that age. And our parents would ring and they'd ask long series of questions to try to figure out which one they were talking to. Because they didn't know who picked up the phone, and it was so fun to be really vague and, like, not help them out to see how long it took them. And I'm really sorry, Mum.
Yeah, eventually they'd crack. Oh, their favourite one is, what's your sister doing? You know, and they try and work it out. I used to just say she's taking drugs and sleeping around.
Does that give it away?
Well, I was the one who tended to do that more than Anitra. I think
yeah,
it's fair to say
I go,
that.
No, let me tune into the psychic radar. Nope, can't hear her.
As you can tell by now, none of us are film studies academics, so don't expect a deep, informed analysis grounded in literature. Wait, this week we're joined by an actual academic expert,
yes.
Dr. Pauline Reynolds. Now, you might know Pauline from her book, Anti-Intellectual Representations of American Colleges and Universities, Fictional Higher Education, from January 2017. And it's probably, you probably don't know her from that because it's kind of niche. I mean, I've read it, but not many people will have. But I benefited from it and more people should read it. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Pauline.
Thanks, Inga. Hi, everyone. So I'm Pauline Reynolds, and I'm a professor, and I'm also a recent ex-department chair. I actually worked on that book with Barbara Tablowski, so I should probably give her a shout out. You can hear I'm an English lass, but I work in the US at the University of Redlands. And as I write about representations of higher ed in pop culture, Netflix did actually have this show in my recommendations.
Fancy.
Respect.
Ooh.
So we are 4 white female academics located in Australia, plus this week an extra white woman, Pauline, located in the United States. We've done various jobs inside academia, but of course we can't claim to have experienced everything. What you're going to hear in this episode is our point of view, and we want to know what other people think. When we find good writing or other podcasts about The Chair, we'll share them with you, and we've got an exciting one at the end of this show. You can also write in with your point of view, and we'll tell you more about how to do that in our correspondence section at the end. This week, we're talking about episode 2, The Faculty Party, and Anitra is going to do the recap and she's going to run the panel discussion. Is that right? You're doing that?
I feel very nervous, but I feel like I'm in a good producer's hands and I can do this. And
all
I
right,
hope I
take
wrote
it
something
away.
Right. So we open on Daphne's Prius parked outside Bill's house. Daphne's writing a card as her friend studies her phone and asks if Bill is hot. Taffer acts offended, saying, "Stop, his wife died." To which the friend replies, "That's literally the start of every romance novel," which made me laugh because kinda. And I think it lends strength to Inga's thesis of the show as a romance, which will probably really annoy Megan. In fact, this episode probably really annoys Megan. There's a lot of romance for Ji-Yoon and Bill. I'm going to argue that it's a whole rom-com story arc on its own. Daphne counters that she likes Bill because he's smart and sad. Ooh. And when her friend looks at her knowingly, she admits, yeah, he's hot too. So go, Daphne. She then dashes out and furtively leaves a package on his doorstep. It's very high school, and Daphne really isn't very far out of high school and definitely should not be in a romantic relationship with Bill at all because high school. Then she gets back in the car. Her friend's frowning at her phone and asks Bill's full name and then shows Daphne the meme, followed by one of the best lines in this episode, which is, "You just gave your pie to a Nazi." Come to the titles. Let's just admire the bimbo for a short moment. And the music, and I think the music is the music each time now, actually, but it's a snippet of lilting harpsichord music, which I hadn't noticed before, and it made me think of those adaptations of Jane Austen movies. It kind of suits the theme of this episode, which does a lot of work on the romance between Ji-Yoon and Bill. Fade to Ji-Yoon running up the stairs, briefing what is obviously a new babysitter. Ji-Yoon is disheveled and in a hurry, and the babysitter smiles but seems to have first day nerves. Ji-Yoon knocks on Juju's door for her to come out, rattles the handle, but the door's locked. The babysitter suggests that Juju may not be in there, but Ji-Yoon confides that Juju just likes to fuck with my head. And the babysitter looks disconcerted as Juju yells back, "Fuck," from behind the door. And Ji-Yoon sarcastically replies, "That you heard." The babysitter then asks to use the bathroom. And Ji-Yoon tells her that Juju will make an appearance as soon as I've gone. And Ji-Yoon's obviously used to talking to daycare teachers. Like, these are the only people you can ever talk to like this. They look after your kids too. They know what little shits they can be. But it's clear she's misjudged this one. Cut to Bill finishing in the bathroom. See, he does shower, Inga. He showers.
Thank God for that. Thank God. Oh,
and he's texting his daughter. He's on the other side of the parenting time-wise, but it's the same dynamic. We can see a chain of his unanswered texts, starting with, "Hey," then went to specific questions, the classic parenting technique. He adds another question about the library, and she immediately responds with, "Other people's parents don't text their children 5 times a day, which is such accurate Zoomer texting dialogue. He just takes a breath, drops a phone on top of the toilet cistern, which is a bit ill. Anyway, straightens his tie and walks out. On the doorstep, he finds the pie and looks around as he opens the card on which Daphne has written, "Do I dare eat a peach?" His head snaps back, quite hilarious actually, and he looks around very nervously. Bill is, once again, surprised his car is gone. Then he opens his garage. Cut to some jaunty music and Bill's pedalling to campus on his daughter's small pink bike. He looks happy, like for the first time. Mm-hmm. At a stop sign, a young boy tells him, "That's a girl's bike." And he yells back, "That's what the girl I stole it from said." And I think this gives us a glimpse of why Ji-Yoon likes him so much, actually. It's very funny. Cut to the bathroom door at Ji-Yoon's house. And Juju pokes her stuffy Hello Kitty around the door and in a really high-pitched voice says, "Hi." The babysitter looks disconcerted. And when Juju opens the door, she switches into babysitter mode. Or she tries to, because she's still sitting up in the toilet. She's clearly off her game.
Like pulling down her jumper, right?
Yeah, she's like, what? Who am I in this moment? Juju just stares at her silently and for too long. And she looks flat out adorable here. She's got a cute little shirt on and her stuffy, but it's also very kid in a horror movie as well. Babysitter again tries to get her to leave, and we can almost see Juju calculating how best to freak the poor babysitter out. She finally goes for, "Do you have fur on your vagina?" and then asking if she can see it. When the babysitter says no, because, you know, no, Juju counters with, "It's just like any other part of your body." And when the babysitter says, no, it isn't, Juju goes into mini lecturer remote, like she tilts her head, saying, "It is, when you think about it." Such daughter of academic. Anyway, the babysitter hustles back to Ji-Yoon and says she has to go. Ji-Yoon is immediately suspicious and asks, "What did she do? I'm so sorry," which made me laugh because I believe there are two types of parents in this world. One of them reacts this way and the other one never does, and that's also what's wrong with the world. The babysitter says, I don't know. I don't want to say I was triggered by your daughter, but boundaries are important in the workplace, and clearly there are no boundaries in this house, which is actually a bit of a theme throughout the rest of the episode, I think. As she leaves, Ji Yoon runs after her, insisting, "We totally have boundaries," and offering her more money, but it's too late. Cut to Ji Yoon's father's house, and she's begging him to take Juju, and he's very reluctant. And he points out he's old, the Juju doesn't speak Korean, and what if something happens? Foreshadowing. But Ji Yoon gives him no choice, and she just leaves. Her father says nothing. He looks at Juju aggressively rocking on her chair in a way the kids are totally not supposed to. Very Juju. Bill enters a faculty party on campus. There's lots of middle-aged white people eating crudité, and I put that word in just because I wanted to say crudité.
Fair.
He murmurs hi guys to some groups. He heads to the food table, puts the pie down. Dean Larson comes up to him and asks if he bakes it, and as he scoffs, Larson picks up the card and opens it, saying, "We're not above recycled gifts here." Bill tries to stop him but fails, and Larson says, "Prufok, a bit predictable, no." And then, "Oh, good, a sex scandal. I think that completes my set," but without any real heat because, of course. Bill insists that he didn't dare eat it, and Larson leans over and says, "Be careful, this department's hanging by a thread." Now, I like poetry. I even read poetry, but I went to design school, so I had to look up who this Prufrock was. And this line, "Dare I eat a peach," is from the poem The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot, who's a modernist poet. Now, Bill's a modernist scholar, so very appropriate. And I'm quoting from Wikipedia here, don't at me. The poem apparently relays the thoughts of a sexually frustrated middle-aged man who wants to say something but is afraid to and ultimately does not, which makes me think I will spend some time reading some feminist critiques of this poem later, as they are bound to be good. But yes, there's this very predictable Daphna, so suggestions for Daphna from any modernist poetry experts would be very welcome. You're in college now, do better. Cut to Joan, Jazz and Ji-Yoon talking about au pairs at the party. The server comes past and Ji-Yoon grabs two wines and offers one to Jazz, who refuses, and Joan scoffs that Jazz thinks there are too many bigwigs here to drink. Her privilege is showing, but I also kind of love that she doesn't give a shit. Jazz is completely correct. She will be held to a different standard. So Ji-Yoon smiles, acknowledges it, saying it's a fine line. And also, I think one of the best lines in the episode, "No one can get Joan drunk pre-tenure." And I'm over Joan insisting that she doesn't do that anymore, which she totally does, points out that they'll have to schmooze the provost and Dean Larson, so bottoms up. They all look unenthused and they clink glasses as if the wine is medication, which it is.
I think it is medication.
There's a little cutaway scene, I think, at that point where they go and show you what they're dealing with and you're just like, yeah, you're going to need wine for that, girls. That's going to be a thing. Next we see Ji Yoon walking through the party and she looks uncomfortable in a way that only Sandra Oh can do.
True.
When Dean Larson chaps her on the shoulder, he says he got her email. So there's actually email. This is good. He stutters on a name that's not even remotely like Yaz's before Ji Yoon corrects him. He says, "Shouldn't they invite an outside person?" Indicating that he hasn't, of course, replied to her email. And Ji Yoon points out that Yale and Chicago are eyeing Yaz, launches into an explanation of the recognition of the distinguished lectureship. That's kind of a hard phrase to say, guys. Sorry about that. But Larson rudely cuts her off with what he probably thinks is an amusing aside about mini quiches making him feel like Gulliver. And when Ji-Yoon doesn't react, he tries it again. And then he checks that she got the reference. And she impatiently says that she does because, like, even I didn't have to Wikipedia that one. Ji-Yoon points out that the faculty is 87% white. And he rolls his eyes at this point. But she continues that they've put the same picture of her on the recruitment catalogue for at least 5 years and they need more women of colour. Dean Larson sees his chance. He puts his arm around Ji-Yoon, turning to show her the three faculty on the list, saying as soon as one of them retires, gets kicked out or dies. He chomps down on his quiche while Ji-Yoon looks at his hand on her shoulder, again, in a way that only Sandra Oh can. Elliot and Mikhail are discussing the future being online and segue smoothly into discussing Elliot's colon, which I just love that juxtaposition. That made me laugh so much. Yaz is nearby inspecting one of Elliot's books, which has an old cover because it's a little bit battered, but it looks otherwise unread when she opens it.
Nice.
Yeah, which I thought was lovely. So type analysis time. I looked it up. Well, I tried to look it up. But anyway, this cover's set, I think, in Optima. It's certainly in that family. It's a family that can't decide if it's a serif or a sans serif, which is one of the reasons I just hate it. This type A, it screams pretentious monologue, which this book clearly is. I think it's called The Woe and the Wither or something, something, something. It's a terrible title. I couldn't quite get the whole thing on screen. It's also a typeface that's used on tombstones, so there's an upset about that. We should pause for a moment, though, so we can admire the craft of academic book cover design, which is done with absolutely no money. So hence the fields of tasteful blue and the typographic solution. And I like the picture on the back, which is a young Elliot, and he literally is pretty much the same as the current Elliot. So that's a nice little signal. Elliot has not changed. And graphic designers who design for television have the best job ever, because that would be such a fun thing to design. And it's so perfectly done. Anyway, enough of the type nerdery.
Love
the
it.
Dedication page says, for my students, and Yaz's expression when she looks up is just great. It's like this calculating look. I actually couldn't figure out what it was. It was like there's a bit of, aha, sure you care about your students. And it's almost like this calculating, like horror movie kind of look where she's like, I've got you now. Anyway, it's this great look. And she heads over unenthusiastically to sit next to Elliot. So he attempts to compliment her on her dress, which is amazing. And he says, it looks like you put three different dresses together, but in a good way, which it does look like that. And if anyone else had said this, it would have been much more charming, but Elliot said it, so it just wasn't. And Yaz says thank you in a way that clearly isn't. Invites him for a coffee to talk about grading criteria, which, Elliot, come on, that's late. They've already started semester, please. She must be very annoyed about that by now. Elliot says it's his research day tomorrow and that he's heading to the archives. And then they connect over how peaceful the place is, saying something about North Star. I thought there might be a Moby Dick reference here. I couldn't find anything, but I'd love to know if there's actually a Moby Dick reference, because it's a moment of connection between the two of them, and it's over Melville, which is a nice little moment. Anyway, cut to Joan, who's also reading a book. Bill interrupts her and asks if she's reading literature at a fucking party, and she fake cries and leans on him, begging him to take her home. He laughs and says he'll think about it. And obviously Joan's relationships have no boundaries. She then asks if he reads his student emails, immediately correcting herself that the students love him, that he's over-enrolled. Bill quotes a student eval like straight away that his class is a limp-dick version of his pretentious writing, which is just hilarious. And Joan says, so they read your book. And he says, fuck you, very affectionately. Joan asks how his kid is doing, and Bill says she's sowing her wild oats, he hopes. And then Joan has this great speech about how when she was cute, she was buried in Piers Plowman and The Dream of the Brood, which I looked up both, and they're sadly not as baldy as they sound like they're going to be, but it's a nice little joke that she does. And then she laments that her face is this avalanche and it's too late. To stop it, Bill says, an avalanche of charm and class, and Joan says, lovely, lovely, definitely done. And then she puts her arms around his neck and asks him if he's ready. He asks if they're going to do stuff, but she just points out he deserves romance. And he looks very vulnerable. And I'm really sorry, Megan. Pretty hot in that little moment.
If you could again. See Megan's face now, she's got like that emoji face with the straight line for the mouth. Anyway.
I'm really sorry, Megan, but it's true. Ji-Yoon is walking grimly through the party now, and we hear the line, every semester some theory boy wants to come in and talk about Lacan, which sounds like an inhumanities joke. Does anyone know what that means? No, anyway, I looked up Lacan. I couldn't figure it out. If anyone can tell me what it is, I really want to know, because it seemed kind of funny. Anyway, she sees Bill leaving the party and then finds him in the greenhouse and asks if he's seriously smoking a joint. He points out shit's legal, and she points out the difference between legal and appropriate, and again, different standards. So to me, this is kind of like the meet cute. He compliments on her pretty makeup, and she walks away listing all the things Megan hates about Bill. Put sports coat, scruff, and says he just needs a wide-eyed co-ed. He says he's working on this, and that he checks all the boxes in the disaffected middle-aged white male professor cliche. But, you know, in a way that we're clear that she actually likes him. Bill gives her a pep talk to ignore Larson. He says he quotes Prufrock so they won't notice he's a technocrat for the bean counters upstairs. And she clearly needs his talk. And she repeats, I'm the chair, several times before refusing the joint in case they ask her to speak. Megan probably hates that Bill leads her astray. She does smoke the joint and, well, he's just Bill. Back at the party, there's dinging glasses, and we know right away Ji-Yoon is completely screwed. She and Bill are holding each other up, and they have to do that thing where they try to be sober. And as the dean talks about the department needing her vision, Ji-Yoon gives Bill this look of death as only Sandra Oh can, and she tries very hard to walk away. Bill pushes her out in front. He says, she's got this. And there's this little moment where Elliot really doesn't try too hard to clap, and Joan stomps Mikhail's foot to wake him up, and Jazz just looks worried. There's just this great little, your colleagues are like, oh, shit, what's happening now? Ji-Yoon stands on the staircase for way too long before she blurts out, English is such a great department. She's like so totally off her face. And then she tries to give a short speech, but Bill prompts her, and she's off, and she does this kind of brilliant speech about how students have things to worry about now: climate change, racism, the prison industrial complex, homophobia. And then her phone rings and it's her dad, and Bill helps her out again, suggesting that she should take it this time. So she wraps up quickly saying Yaz has the distinguished lectureship, and Joan is totally thrilled, and Yaz looks totally shocked. Larson quotes Shakespeare's "Yet she be little, she be mighty," which is really patronising, and gets corrected on his attribution by Yaz. He then congratulates Jasmine, which he wearily corrects, and Joan's had enough. Or she's Joan drunk, or both. And she shouts, Yaz, McKay, Doctor, Professor. Larson remarks that Jane has really already introduced herself to the bar, and Joan ignores him and starts to big up Yaz, calling her the future of American studies. And she's pretty great, but then she loses her way a little. And Larson excuses himself right in the middle, and Joan immediately falls into that polite shutdown nod face that we've all done. And as he walks away, she says, don't do us any favours, fucktard, which I just love Joan in that moment. Bill finds Ji-Yoon in the faculty lounge trying to pull on a jacket, clearly still very high. Juju's missing. He offers to drive and asks if she has the right coat, and she looks confused as only Sandra O can, because she doesn't. They rush out. We see that Ji-Yoon left behind her phone and that a message from Lila has popped up asking her to call back about Bill. Trouble is brewing. There's a panicked conversation with Ji-Yoon's father about Juju climbing out the window, which gets momentarily and amusingly derailed by Hello Kitty and her father's boycott of Sanrio before they're in the car. Bill's in the back, Appa is driving and telling Ji-Yoon in Korean that she could be in Ann Arbor with her ex-fiancé and a real family and not pining for this crumpled man. She argues back that she does have a real family and that Bill is not crumpled, before her father sticks in the knife, saying she can't compete with his dead wife. Now, as the daughter of a father who has no filter, I can completely relate to this conversation. Ji-Yoon insists that they're just friends. Bill hears his name, wonders if they're talking about him, and Ji-Yoon says, it's not all about you. And then he wonders what Bill means in Korean before they spot Juju, who looks really unimpressed by being found by these people. She's got the, oh, great, these people found me again. Look, it's fantastic. After dropping off her father, Ji-Yoon and Juju have this really intense and what seems like a familiar argument where Juju insists he isn't her real grandfather and Ji-Yoon is not her real mother. Ji-Yoon is upset, but I think she handled it as well as she could possibly do, because it's a really hard conversation. And Juju hangs her head and Ji-Yoon tries not to cry. Bill tries to break the tension by suggesting they get fried chicken. Megan is probably with Ji-Yoon in this moment as she tells Bill off and says she has to put in her time at the party and now is not the time for slacking off. And then we cut to Bill, Juju and Ji-Yoon absolutely slacking off. They're having a great time eating junk food and 10-pin bowling. And Juju's loving being with Bill, who's great with her. Ji-Yoon's enjoying their rapport, and at the same time, she looks a bit sad. She notices her phone is gone, and the rest of the scene, they have a really lovely time, is intercut with vignettes of the students viewing the Bill meme and looking disturbed and outraged and talking to each other. The scene ends with Bill encouraging Ji-Yoon to see the white guys of the pins and knock them down, which I just love. Juju high-fives Bill, ignoring Ji-Yoon, who wistfully looks at another mother hugging her child. And this scene, I think, has a lot to say about what's real and what's not real. And I like that without their phones, Bill and Ji-Yoon are now free of what's happening online, which is both real and not real. And this is a sort of a sweet scene. It's actually in the romance arc. It's the high points. The only way now is down. Back in the car, Ji-Yoon asks Bill why he's so great with Juju, and he tells her right away because she's not his, which is truth. You know, everyone gets along with everybody else's kids, but their own kids. Ji-Yoon talks about how Juju never crawls into her lap, which will be important later, and how much harder and unnatural mothering is than she expected. And lady, yes, we've been there. Mine are not even adopted, so feel you. Bill gently teases her about this some profile book where she lied about cooking and said she's a fucking menace around anything that needs to be heated. And he reveals that he knows a lot about her. And then Ji-Yoon reels off all the reasons why she's a raw deal. And she doesn't even have a dog. And why would Juju's mother have picked her? And Bill gives her another lovely pep talk about how he would pick her and that he would eat dry cereal the rest of his days to hang with this lady. And then he gives her the look but Ji-Yoon misses it or maybe doesn't want to see mm-hmm. it, and he suggests mm-hmm. to take her car. And there's an amusing bit where they're both struggling to get Juju out of her seat and their faces are very close and they talk about how to get it out, which is kind of funny. And then we see that Bill might kiss her before the car starts rolling and they panic, and then the car rolls over Bill's foot and the romantic scene's over for now. Cut to what's probably hours later after the ER visit back at Bill's house. Juju is asleep and Bill's foot is in a cast. Ji-Yoon sits down next to her on the couch and she shakes two bottles and suggests a little cocktail of Percocet and Vicodin and yes, please. She's very adorable, so Bill leans in to kiss her and she pulls back looking freaked out and says she should take Juju home. Bill asks if she ever thinks about it and if she's going to pretend that she doesn't know what he's talking about, which is a very adult kind of conversation at this point. I thought it was quite nicely done. And she jumps up and then says he's grieving, which sounds like an excuse. And he asks why he has a raging boner. And Megan probably really hates this bit because Ji-Yoon's obviously very tempted. She tells him he's high, he's cross-eyed, and repeatedly tells him to stop when he starts giving her cute and hot looks. I'm really sorry, Megan. We have to get through this. She sits back down, then realizes what an epically bad idea it is and jumps back up again, telling him no one will take her seriously if they get together. People will think he supports her ideas because he wants to get into her pants. And Bill says he genuinely does support her ideas and he genuinely wants to get into her pants. So Ji-Yoon's very flattered, but she's sensible and she leaves, and well done. Well done, Ji-Yoon, for resisting the Bill. The next morning, Ji-Yoon wakes up with a pile of books around her and she smiles and carefully picks out her clothes, and there's a hipster cheerful song playing over the scene. Everyone's getting ready to leave the house. And remember when we did that? Do you remember when we used to leave the house?
Yeah.
That was good. Ji-Yoon doesn't even get too down when Juju screws up her face at the choice between the two Lunchables. And I'm glad Pauline is here because Lunchables, they're this signifier of bad mothering, bad working mothering. But I think they're such a great idea. I was never brave enough to buy them. I'd buy all the things that were in the Lunchables. So right. I would basically give them a Lunchable, but I wouldn't buy a Lunchable. And I think points to Ji-Yoon for just not caring. I think this thing is great. This scene's intercut with Bill on the couch, who also looks happy and quite cute. Sorry, Megan. And Ji-Yoon helps Juju get her shoes on. And that's an echo of her helping Bill the same way in the last episode. And she's then strolling across campus, rocking a scarf and looking happy. Bill's working on his computer and seems to make a decision, stands up, and then he hurts his foot by standing up too fast. This is quite amusing. Come to a close-up of Ji-Yoon's phone on her desk and a lot of all-caps messages from Lila. She calls Lila back and we get the idea that Lila is panicking and not able to tell Ji-Yoon exactly what's wrong. Then Bill comes into her office and he seems breathless, and Ji-Yoon immediately tells Lila that she will call back, which is, you know, anything for Bill. Never mind Lila. Bill's obviously been practicing the speech that he launches into, telling Ji-Yoon she has nothing to prove anymore. Not true. Never done proving ourselves, are we, ladies? He does a little hand gesture towards the generic white guy portrait as he tells her she has ascended the ranks of her profession. Corner office, prestigious journals. He then makes a pitch that he could be an asset, value added. And I love the little neo-liberal university kind of speak there. It's a nice touch. And I'd argue that he kind of would. Like, he did lead her astray, but he also supported and advised her pretty well the previous night. Don't at me, Megan. And this is very like the end of a rom-com where the hero realizes he wants to be with the heroine and declares himself. Maybe we're about to get the happy ending. But as Ji-Yoon stares at him, obviously furiously overthinking it, the faint chance of students gathered outside become noticeable. No Nazis at Pembroke. They both go to the window and a jazzy version of Signs Sealed Delivered I'm Yours starts playing as they slowly realise it's a protest about Bill. And Ji-Yoon looks at Bill in horror and we fade to the credits.
Sound problems, so I'll take over the panel discussion, but thank you, Anitra, for that opus of a recap. That was a huge effort in writing and in reading. We have to stop quite a few times because a certain young man in your household doesn't know what streaming is, and we got some critical dropouts there. All right, so a quick reaction time. What did you all think? Megan?
I still hate Bill. That's all I can say.
I laughed so hard when I read that on the screen. It was even better when you said it.
Narelle, how about you?
Well, we start off with the comment of he's smart and sad, which is Daphne to her friend. And then we see this scene unravel, and it's beginning of the bill unraveling and the meme and what's happened. And I also love the 10-pin bowling scene leading into the car conversation. And I particularly, my favourite part of the love arc was I pick you and I'd eat dry cereal for the rest of my days to hang with you. And I just like, oh, authentic, real love story. Seeing each other. Oh, 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 these two are connecting. Sorry, Megan.
In a broader romance arc, this particular episode is the No Way beat, where you see a glimpse of what the relationship could be between these two people if they could ever get over both their own internal and external obstacles. And it doesn't have to be a no way for both. It can be a no way for just one of them. And clearly Bill, he's all in. And she's very tempted, but she's right about all the power relations.
Yeah,
and
it's an epically bad idea. It's bad.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is one way where I like how the show plays with cliches and sort of leans right into it until it pulls back at the last minute, and I really like that. Mm. How about you, Pauline?
I loved how this really exposed kind of what it's like to be a mama scholar. So she's trying to get her childcare, she's getting ready for the event, she's trying to rely on her dad again, and she has no time to consider how she actually needs to be present as a new leader at this faculty party. I think I really loved how the show portrayed that quite authentically, actually, thinking about myself as a mama scholar. And there's always these things going on and your personal life is going on. You've got people calling you, a child coming home sick and all of that stuff. So it was great to see her having to deal with that and still trying to lead and talking about scholarship and teaching as well as being a parent. So I like that a lot. I also love the dialogue in the car with Bill. And for me, it wasn't the cereal bit. I think it was the bit just before when he's talking about the birth mother and saying that he saw a kick-ass single mum and I'd pick you. I like that. Yeah.
That was cool.
You say, just because we've got you here as an expert, Pauline, you're saying that women academics are not often authentically portrayed. Is this one of the rare times you've seen an authentic portrayal? Are there others?
I think so, yeah, because often there's quite a lot of research from different disciplines, so like the sciences, for example, that show that women academics, when they're present in TV shows or movies, things like that, they're always there as the love interest. And of course, because of your rom-com thing, yes, she is a potential love interest, but she keeps on holding off Bill. So they're either sexualized or objectified. They're not often portrayed as complete academics. I would say they may only be portrayed as their teachers and not necessarily as good as the men, or sometimes like in the mirror has two faces, that their expertise is shown to be teaching while the man is doing all the research. So they're never shown to be somebody who's got the complete package. There is a show called The Quad that's on BET here, but that shows women in leadership positions as administrators, black women at a historically black college. And I think this show it's like an academic novel, but it's an original TV show, right? It's got all the parts. Yes, there's still exaggerations or things that are for us realistic to make a point. But I think there's enough there, enough of a complete picture to see lots of different aspects about what it's like to be a female academic and potentially a woman of color. Although, of course, I say that as a white woman, then, I may have that wrong.
Yeah, and we'll be pointing you at a pod where some women of colour do talk about it. I think that they point out some interesting differences. But thank you. It's good to hear the academic version of what we reckon.
Proper analysis.
We can often think this is what's happening, but it's good to have it confirmed. All right, let's dig a little deeper now that we're in a nerd academic space. I now want us to think about what's the most realistic scene and what is it about that scene or scenes that really captured or critiqued academic life. How about you, Megan?
I think the party scene is really amazing. As an introvert, really makes my skin crawl, the Dean's jokes about his Swiftie and quiches, the comment about tomorrow is my research day. That's a really nice outfit, Elliot says to you. Joan's avalanche face comments, so many moments of erg. at academic parties.
They're not really parties, are they, Megan? They're not really parties, are they? They're kind of torture devices, aren't they?
It's definitely well, I think a work event.
That's why they're there, for torture. Well, I just correlate it with academic conference dancing.
And oh!
And in my head,
oh, the mental picture.
It's the same. And I'm just like, oh, God, that's so not where I want to be ever.
Okay, yeah, I don't, that's not, can't top that. It's the top moment of the episode. I once wrote a blog post about how academic writing is like a painful upper middle class party. And this is exactly the kind of party I had in mind when I wrote that blog post. And I found this one actually really triggering. I really have to build myself up to these events. And then I hate myself sometimes for enjoying them. And I wonder if I enjoy them sometimes sort of despite themselves. And there's lots of little moments in this party of microaggressions. So there's where Dean can't remember Yaz's name. And then Joan's trying to defend Yaz at the party. Mm. But even she calls her doctor and then corrects herself to professor. And there's a subtle, isn't there, but really critical distinction between doctor and professor. I mean, in an English system, professor is a much higher status than doctor. You don't get to professor for quite a while. I mean, I know in the US people are called professors just for, seems like anyone who walks into
a classroom. They used to call me professor. I'd be like, stop calling me that. And then I'm like, no, that's okay.
So people are really specific about, because we have so many adjuncts though as well, and some who may not have a doctorate, there are some people who are very specific about being called the doctor title, particularly when they're not yet a full professor. So for some people it's very specific.
And so is it a good thing to be called a doctor, or is it kind of a put down?
I think it might depend on institutional type and sometimes personal preferences. I know in my experience, it's not a put down, that it could be, it's a choice, doctor, professor, right? It's sort of a, what do you want to be named? Because she is an assistant professor, but, you know, I read that a little differently to you.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
So Joan's basically saying she's all the things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, okay. Right.
Yeah, oh, okay. Because I really read it as Joan positioning her as a postdoc, or like a person still doing their kind of early doctoral work. And then anyway, yeah, but this is, it's good to have you along, Pauline, to clarify different systems. And actually, like, this moment for me is when you look at Yaz, you can see she's grateful, and she's a great actor, right? So she can see that she's grateful that Joan's supporting her. At the same time, she's kind of wishing it wasn't Joan, because Joan is absolutely fully drunk at this point.
Yeah.
And she really thinks she's being helpful and supportive and being an ally, but it's not the kind of help you want as Yaz. Mm-hmm. Like, all Yaz wants is to be able to speak for herself, and all Yaz needs is to be listened to and for the dean to actually be fucking interested. And
yeah, can you imagine him being interested? Not at all.
No.
Not even a little bit.
So, you know, this is a kind of white feminism that people get angry about, and I can really understand why. Like, you think you're being helpful and you're being vocal and you're being an advocate, but what you need to do is step back and make the space, and Joan doesn't know how to do that. And I've met a lot of female academics of a certain age, I think, who don't know how to do that. And unfortunately, they're the people that trained and influenced me. And so it's a real job of work for me to do that also, to just be aware, to step back. The other microaggression that in this episode was the dean putting his arm around Joan and turning her to look at the three academics he wants to sack.
Yeah.
And her little look, and as only Sandra Oh can do, had his hand on her shoulder. And the look is like, why is this hand on my shoulder? Mm-hmm. What's it for? Mm. Why are you doing it? I'm uncomfortable. She knows it isn't really sexual, but she also knows it's not sexual. Mm. And she's doing that calculus that women always have to do. So should I tell him to stop? And you can see it all in a microsecond, her then deciding, no, this is too tiny. I'm just going to ignore it like I have 10,000 other times. And this is 95% of microaggressions in the workplace. And men go, what are you actually worried about? But flip it for a moment. Imagine if she turned him and held her arm on that shoulder for too long, how would he have felt? Mm-hmm. And I was really quite triggered by this moment, because when I first went into architecture offices, I used to do a lot of the rendering and animation for senior men who didn't know how to use a computer. And one of their favourite techniques of kind of microaggression, kind of sexualizing a moment would be to stand behind me while I was doing something on the screen and put both arms on my shoulders. Then take a moment to lean in and look down my top and squeeze and say, you're doing a great job. And it was just so icky. Like, anyway, so I just had a real moment.
There's actually a website called Hovering Art Directors. Of art directors doing that to junior staff.
And they not just me.
They even do it to men, you know. It's just, yeah, it's a thing and it's gross and you're right. Yeah.
And it's the second time he manhandles her, because when she's walking past him, he grabs her instead of saying,
oh, yeah, that's right.
He grabs her and pulls her back when he wouldn't have done that to a male chair or a male colleague.
Yeah, he didn't touch
100%
Bill.
No.
He's in the Bill. No. The way he talked to her was completely different. Yeah. Ew.
Yeah. Ew. Okay, Narelle, awesome. What about you? While we're in a feminist rage, are you going to pull us out of the feminist rage spiral?
So I was thinking about the start of the evening event, and when the dean's talking to GUN and connecting on a work email that was just been sent. So that element's so relatable. You're in a social setting, but then you're talking about a work item and it's trying to solve a problem. So it's all like you're networking, but you also are still doing work. And that element there added with alcohol. And sometimes I think, my goodness, how many decisions are made at these type of events with the influence of alcohol? It might help with some innovation, but I slightly suspect some deals are done that might not be so good for people.
Yeah, very good point.
And I really hated how he spoke to her. And it's kind of like on that, he just thought he was so important, and the whole focus on the mini quiche and going through what that all was and cutting her off and, you know, mansplaining her and trying to, like, you know, really influence her in ways that, you know, I didn't really like. And I felt I was a little bit triggered perhaps because I could think of so many awkward situations with older males, particularly in the academic networking social of events and occasions, where they just really are not listening to you at all. But it's even worse than the everyday aspect, right? Really highlighted out there. So
I also like that she didn't play, though. She didn't laugh.
I like that too.
She didn't go, oh, Gulliver, ha ha ha, because I would have. I was like, props to you for not doing that to you.
You know, like, I clearly got she's done it a lot, right? Like, she's an expert at deflecting that. Yeah.
Yeah, she's totally present with what's going on. And the other thing that I was thinking about was Yaz's request for a meeting for planning with Elliot and his response of tomorrow's my research day. Mm-hmm. So there's an element there, you know, layers to this conversation in terms of a research day. And Pauline, you indicated this a little bit earlier as well. It's the males doing research. This is the only time we really hear about it. The women do the teaching. So that's that playing there. And then you've got the flip side to it, that it's a comment that we hear so much in academia. Tomorrow's my research day. I'm not coming to this meeting because it's my research day. And so you've got this something like that sits in our industry. Like, my partner is not an academic and he knows how important a research day is, how I look forward to it, how it's a day where I get to write or I'm doing that deep thinking on something. And, you know, that, you know, how that comment is placed in there is really interesting at the dinner party or the social event.
Do you ever get a research day, though? Because my research day was always Friday. It wasn't an official research day, but it was a day where I'd write online classes and stuff. And all the other work, because, you know, there's a lot of work in academia. All the other work would push the research out, and I'd go, I'll just clean this up before lunchtime, or I'll just get this done before I start my research. And so it gets squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. Like, do you actually get research time, Narelle? Because that's good planning.
For you being an associate dean, I would say yes. I could carve out my time, and very nicely I would have the gift of being able to control the calendar that way. And now I'm lucky if I get a solid hour here, there, or there. It's just carving it out is different. So I think it, you know, it also speaks to what is that like as you move through your career trajectory, and especially if you move into leadership. But then also, what does that mean for early career research who's starting out as well, who has heavy load of teaching? is fighting for a research allocation. And I know I've had conversations over the years with Megan and Inga a lot about, you know, I've done X amount of publications this year, which will earn me more research hours for the next year. But then the goals are shifted. And so you're forever striving to get those hours that can add up to a research day as well. So it's a tricky comment.
Yeah. And that doesn't happen to Elliot.
So many layers.
Elliot totally gets his research day. Nobody gets
it. Oh, he makes sure of it. For sure. How about you, Pauline?
I have things about the faculty party too, but I did have something from right at the beginning of the episode as well. The text conversation, well, one-sided text conversation that Bill has with his daughter to start with. Because what I loved is that, you know, that the final thing he asks is she going to the library after class? Because, of course, a professor's going to push the academic engagement. I wondered if he was, like, you know, taking the piss or teasing as a way to try and make her respond. But we don't know enough about their relationship to gauge if he's actually taking the piss. So I took that at face value. I could imagine myself doing that. And I do it.
Right?
There we go.
Yeah. Now he's in uni. I mean, now he's in uni at home in his bedroom next door. I pop by and I just stand in the door like, what's going on? He goes, why are you here? And I said, well, I don't know, I'm just checking in. It's like, I'm studying, go away. You know, so, you know, I feel like academic surveillance is the thing in this house anyway.
Do you also do the whole, have you met with your professor outside of class?
Oh, my God, yes.
Have you had coffee or tea with them? Because you do know that academic research shows that if...
100%. But he also knows that my involvement at some level, even if it's proofing his essay, is a whole grade extra. So he's certainly down with me correcting his grammar. Although I did buy him a Grammarly subscription, which really improved our relationship. Yes. So what about the party, Pauline?
Oh, so I think that what I thought was particularly realistic is some of the things that we were talking about, right, about Ji-Yun's experience of women's leadership at the party. So she's poured, she's interrupted, she's mansplained, she's set up to speak without lead time, her ideas are ignored, she has to deal with family issues, right? All of that. And you mentioned earlier on about how perfect Sandra Oh is with a look at the hand on the shoulder. Yeah. That was just wonderful. And I know I was triggered with that bit because I have memories. Right?
Stays in the body, doesn't it?
Yeah, you go right
back.
Yeah,
it really does. I felt my shoulders were like in my ears.
Yep. It's like, ugh, stop it.
And then I thought something else that was really realistic was Ji-Yun as a woman of colour having to remind her white male dean that the university is 87% white and that she's the one advocating for a black colleague and she's the one thinking about strategies to retain her and to help support her success and not the dean and that he cuts her off again.
He rolls his eyes at her. Like I went back and rewound it. Like he completely dismisses her at that moment. Like with his body, he knows better than to say something, right? But it's
The physical power, right, that he's taller than her and, yeah, it's horrible. Hated that.
All right. Oh, I think we've really dwelled in the reel a bit too long, maybe even for us.
Sorry.
So I want to move us on now to unpicking the most unrealistic details or scenes. And I'm also interested, do you wish it was true? So, Megan, how about you?
Okay, I'm just going to bring up the bowling scene and who gets a strike after a gutter? Like, you know, her bowling improves so much.
That is unrealistic, you are right.
And people keep on losing their phones and what is that even? Like, you know, my phone is attached to me always.
Like, I don't care how high you are, right, Megan? Like, where's my phone?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah, correct.
I actually had a hard time finding an unrealistic scene in this episode, I think because so much of it was realistic. I had to watch it for the fourth time. But the thing that really struck me is they don't call the cops for the missing child, right? I have two experiences when my child was that age of losing them. And the cold dread and the absolute anxiety and the immediate panic that almost paralyzes you. And I'm just like, why aren't they calling the cops? It just, it struck me as, and why are they just driving around trying to find her? But then maybe it's happened before, maybe it's happened before lots of times and they've found her lots of times. And that look that Juju gives them when they find her is just so classic. That kid is such a great actor, isn't she?
Like, it's like she's thinking, I was having the best time and now you lot show up.
Yeah, you people again.
So
why couldn't good people find me?
Yeah. I mean, you just, you do never see a look like that really from a kid that age. I mean,
no.
No, but her acting is superb. How about you, Narelle?
Jane drunk at the evening event and the sexual passes and being handsy. And I really hated this part. And I actually felt like, of someone that has experienced very inappropriate passings at different events multiple times throughout my career, I really wanted to say it's really around the other way. Mm-hmm. It's more likely the men doing this sort of stuff at these events than, and I don't think I've ever seen a woman be drunk at an academic event to the point of where she was at.
What did you think, Pauline?
I think the thing that I felt was unrealistic was that Ji-Yoon keeps on putting others off, particularly women. So that was happening in the first episode that she let Joan down. But in this episode, you know, she gets the text messages from Lila when she finally sees her phone and she calls her back immediately and she seems horrified or whatever she says to her. But then Bill runs in and she puts the phone down. And I think that's really unrealistic that as chair, there's a desperate doc student who's reacting at something at the other end of the phone, and the person who's rushed in hasn't indicated there's an emergency or anything like that, just said hi. That was it.
In that way that Megan hates.
So I didn't like that at all. I did think that was unrealistic. And you wouldn't do that. Didn't you last time talk about a duty of care?
I think. Yeah. Yes.
And,
yes.
And, you know, thinking about that she has a responsibility towards the students as well as the professors, that there wasn't anything that Bill did when he came in to suggest that his need was any professionally any more vital than what Lila needed on the phone. So I didn't think that was realistic.
True.
And you had another thing here about not having anything to prove?
Oh, yeah. So I was going backwards and forwards about the realism of that, because it is unrealistic that she doesn't have anything to prove, because she'll always have something to prove. But then I thought it was realistic that he thinks that because he has that privilege.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I actually, now that I'm a professor and, you know, the so-called made it in my profession, that I get a lot of that talk from male colleagues, I have to admit, who say, why are you worried about that, or why are you still doing that, or things of that order. And I just think, well, I can't not do those things. I mean, come on. And then it's sort of sometimes even framed as a weakness or a waste of my time or a sign of my unprofessionalism that I'd even bother. And I'm really noticed that, and I've only been professor for a year. Okay. Team, funniest scene or perhaps the most touching moments for you, Megan?
I'm going for the slapstick this week, and Bill jumping up and forgets that his foot has been run over the night before, which I thought was hysterical. The other one that I thought was hysterical was Bill not actually taking the card out of the peach pie box, you know, so easily just remove the card. And then, you know, just now looking at Bill's dorkiness, which is verging on arrogance, the peach pie card and the discussion with the dean, you know, just to tempy everybody else's academic scruff comments, okay? Still focused on Bill, though, so I apologise for that.
Megan, I'm getting the feeling you don't like Bill. I'm
really?
Getting that feeling. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm just getting a vibe.
For me, I do like that almost kiss moment. Like, it's a kind of an echo of their playful tussle in the office. And they're sort of struggling over the seatbelt around Juju.
And I do like in that moment how Ji-Yoon's really much more concerned with her daughter and the seatbelt, and he's in the moment where he's like, this is romantic for me. But, you know, at that moment, Bill's empirically very attractive, I think, and he does wear that scruff well. But I'm actually, I don't find him tempting, but that moment was the only moment where I'm like, oh, I can see it. I can see why she'd want to have a piece of that. But I also have to say I painfully relate to Ji-Yoon as a parent. And I really know what I really related to was how she said it didn't come naturally to her, and that she looked at other mothers and it seemed to be so easy. And I wonder if, like me, she over-intellectualizes the piece of parenting and worries about every move she's making, because as a teacher, you're so used to knowing that how you act and how you behave affects your child. You read a lot of books for knowledge, so you turn to books when you've got a problem with a child. Well, I've talked to a lot of my female colleagues, and we talk about how we've turned to parenting books, and parenting books always have a point of view, you know, and they give you often fear messages. And another friend of mine said that she'd read something that the children do better if they grow up in a household that owns books. But actually, it has nothing to do with the amount of time you spend reading books. Just having them. So she went and bought 10 parenting books and put them on the shelf and then never read them. And she figured that was enough. And her kid's pretty well adjusted. So maybe I shouldn't have overthought it so much. Anyway.
I love it when they find the books when they're older and they find the books and they're like, why did you get this book? They're so insulted. Like, did you just get this book to manage me? Like, you know, I've got like raising boys and, you know, like they're all on the bottom shelf and they just pulled them out. Like, why did you need this? And I'm like, because I needed a book. Okay. I needed to manage you. That is true.
I think, you know, that is the refuge. I mean, when I've got a problem as an academic in my work, I solve my problem with a book or something.
Like actual research.
That's my go-to is all
I'm
saying.
Not Google research. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Google too. But anyway, Narelle, how about you?
Okay, funny, I'm going to go with Bill forgets his car is missing in action.
Still.
And he still forgets. Still. And so he's leaving home to go to class and, oh, he's wearing a tie and looking less disheveled at this moment, which is like the first time we've seen him a little bit more traditional looking. And he rocks up to the traffic light. And the zoomer on the side gives him an elevator, a.k.a. eyes up and down. That's a girl's bike. And Bill responds, hey, that's what the girl I stole it from said. And he rides off through the red lights, ding, ding, and he's giggling. There's no boundaries. His guy's like sort of come, he's like showing his sense of humour coming through, and it was done in such a comedic way. Touching moment I really liked between Bill and Joan talking about his daughter at the party, and it was ever so small but very, very touching. And
you look
for
kind
my
of
heart,
hot, right, Narelle? I mean,
well,
yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Megan.
Yes, he did. He did. And oh, my heart, I was when Juju had gone missing and they were in the car with Ji-Yoon and her dad. And she's, you know, they're speaking Korean and he's paying out on her. And how come she didn't marry Peter? And she could have been in Michigan right now with a real family and not pinned down to this crumpled man. And the only English word they say is Bill. And he asks, are you guys talking about me? And, you know, their responses are, oh, yeah, everything's always about you. The Bill responds with, oh, gee, I wonder what Bill means in Korean. And it's just one of those moments where you're like, oh, they nailed it.
Absolutely. How about you, Pauline?
It's the bathroom moment at the beginning for me that just really cracked me up. I really love that. And I loved that because, of course, an academic teaches their child anatomically correct terms, right? Vagina. I think it that rather than the fur bit was probably what triggered the last on the loo. Yes. You said vagina. So I like that. That was the funniest bit. And touching is the bit that I mentioned earlier on, his nice comments about he'd pick her as for a single mum. Mm-hmm. And that little moment is what I would call the best more than a man child moment. It's that little moment. I can see what she sees in him. But most of the time, he just really annoys me.
Okay, team, let's start to bring this home now. What are the best lines and why? Megan.
Elliot's line about his colonoscopy. I can't even say that properly. So inappropriate as someone else was, you know, chomping into, you know, eating his shrimp. You know, you could eat a shrimp off it. Gross. It does indicate the level of his social connections and the personal nature in the department. They know each other's health status. You know, they know enough about each other to ask about their health. So, you know, they... It's really interesting.
It's kind of nice at the same time as weird and creepy. And the way that Mikhail just gets off the couch and goes, oh, I'm going to get more to eat after they've been talking about colonoscopies. It's like classic. I do like the full horror movie child mode of Juju at the start too, like Pauline. I do like just the tone. It's just like any other part of your body. And she's like, well, no, it isn't. And yes, it is, if you think about it. And then she's just so like G-Yoon in that moment.
Yeah, you can tell she picked that up from her mother. Yeah.
Sort of a mirror of her, which is just so what your kids do. You know, when you hear your kids say something, you're like, oh, that's me. And it's kind of delightful at the same time, kind of creepy and a bit worrying. And I also do love that classic line of G-Yoon to Bill when she catches him smoking a joint. You know, you just need a wide-eyed co-ed and then you'll have successfully checked every box in the disaffected middle-aged white male professor cliche. And nailed it. Absolutely nailed it. How about you, Narelle?
Bill to Ji-Yoon at Tenpin Bowling. I don't want to mansplain, but you just got to let it fly. And then off she goes. She laughs. He connects. There's nurturing. There's caring. She lands it. It's the best shot ever. There's high fives. You know, there's love in the air for the academic.
Oh, beautiful.
Narelle's shipping hard here in this episode.
Yeah, shipping on Bill and Ji-Yoon, definitely. Pauline, what about you?
So you, Inga, you had my two top picks, but then the other one I really like as well is the way that Ji-Yoon's father describes Bill when they're in the car and when he calls him a crumpled man, that she's pining for this crumpled man. It was perfect. So, yeah, that would be my third favourite bit.
You've got here something about Wallet Hub. Well, I didn't get that reference, by the way.
Oh, yeah. So he says that it's in the same kind of sentence. It's a sentence before. He says something about the Michigan's ranking is higher than – is Pembroke, right?
Yes.
Higher than Pembroke, according to Wallet Hub. And I'd never heard of Wallet Hub either, so I sort of looked it up online, and it's like some sort of online financial thing. Like, of course, he's looking at – so these financial advisors to decide which is the best institution, and that her former lover went there and she should have gone there to get a real family.
I is do he like wrong, though? Our father is fond of saying that the true form of appreciation is money.
Yeah, my sincerest form. But I like the little nod there to some sort of academic ranking, but it isn't the ones we'd normally expect, right? So that's pretty funny. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because ranking's so prominent, isn't it, in academic talk of all sorts, like, and it's largely missing in this series. I think it's the only time. Maybe there's one other time where they talk about ranking, but yeah, it's an interesting mix.
Well, it's because it's a fictional institution. We're not quite sure where it ranks, right? Because they talk about Harvard and they talk about Yale, and I think in another episode, and Michigan, as if they're better.
Right.
We don't know.
Well, don't they describe it as a minor Ivy in the first
episode?
Yeah.
So okay.
It ranks, but it's not a name, I'm guessing. Like it's good, but it's not something that people know. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now we're bringing it home, pulling this bus down off the freeway, and we're in our most important and my personal favourite segment, which is the clothes and the outfits. So what was your favourite and why, Megan?
I'm still with Ji-Yoon's clumpy boots and the mid-grey duffel coat with the toggles all done up. I love a good clumpy boot, and that's a good combination for me.
And it works on her really well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It
you
does.
Can see why it's her favourite.
Mm.
Yeah. I like, too, with Ji-Yoon, I liked her high-necked magenta shirt. And it could have been frumpy.
Can I just correct that it's not magenta?
Graphic designer. What colour is it?
Magenta is a bright pink.
It's
burgundy.
I don't think it's too pink for burgundy.
No, it's can a we just say burgundy. Red? It's red, but it's a dark red.
Well, I like the kind of ruffled neck. It would be frumpy. I would argue it would be frumpy on other people, but it's elegant and cool. And she can just wear anything, though. And I do like Bill's comment, are you wearing makeup? And this is me every time I wear makeup because I have makeup for one day of the year when I do the 3-minute thesis MC event on a very big stage, and I own an extensive collection of makeup just for that one day. And then when I wear it, everyone's like, oh, you look really good. And the subtle thing in that is we probably should wear this all the time, but I don't. How about you, Narelle?
I really like Yaz's outfit for the wet drinks. Mm. Stylish, modern, contemporary, but classy. And I also like Ji-Yoon leaving the party with Bill with that, is that your coat? And she puts on someone else's cool, heavy, double-breasted jacket. She pops the collar up. You know, it looks really, really cool in it, but then quickly moves to that awesome duffel jacket.
Yes. Both good coats.
Yes. Pauline, what about you?
It was the red. dark red blouse.
Burgundy. Magenta.
It was formal, it was feminine, it's a power colour. I had a professor when I was at grad school, she was a VP, and she would wear full-on red suit with red high-heel shoes for work. She was rocking that. She looked great, actually. But I also like Joan's simple black ensemble with the pearls. I thought she looked really littery.
That's a really nice dress.
And she has a bit of the Audrey Hepburn about her sometimes, I think. Mm. But she made me think of Audrey Hepburn, so with the black, I don't know.
Yeah, and it had a lovely little cutout at the back or a little kind of...
Yeah, it was clearly expensive, that dress.
Like, yes.
It was expensive. And what I like about Joan too is, like, clearly when she was young, she was really hot and got lots of the guys all the time. And she also doesn't – she kind of makes noises about regretting it, but she doesn't really, you know. We've got a feeling she doesn't give a fuck, actually. Yeah.
But she had her nose put in books. She didn't – she's got that regret of not making use of her cuteness when she had her cuteness.
Yes, maybe so. And I'm also thinking about that red suit, Pauline, that there was a vice chancellor of one of the universities up in the tropics, and she at every conference that I ever saw her speak at would wear a completely white suit. Like, that's a power move. Mm. I can eat cleanly. I never sit on anything that leaves a stain.
Yeah.
And we used to call her the White Queen. And there was another female VC of a very powerful university. She had very determinedly red hair, and she'd wear things in the kind of red, burgundy slash magenta tones. And she was the Red Queen. So it'd be like the White Queen and the Red Queen anyway. I digress. That's all our thoughts and feelings. So what about you? So let's do our correspondence section. And we got so much feedback. I think we were overwhelmed, weren't we? I was, at least. I mean, I know I'm pretty out there on social media, but we were sending each other lots of messages back and forward about things, messages we were getting from people in email and on our phones and on Twitter. So overwhelmingly positive and lots of downloads, which is amazing. Big shout out to Linda the Star, who is actually called Linda the Star. She is a star, but we also call her Linda the Star on Instagram and Twitter. She was the first person to give us an Apple podcast review. Thank you so much for doing that. It really helps people find the pod. And she said in her review, I suspect I'd find actually watching The Chair too painful, and I love that I can listen to intelligent, interesting, humorous and informed women unpacking it instead. It means I'm not missing out on the content and have the bonus of local contextual reflections. Thank you. So we are happy to provide the service of actually watching this on your behalf, Linda, and being triggered and having all the feelings. Mm. So thank you very much. I want to give a special shout out to at Lisa7 Pettifer, who gave us our first retweet recommendation. Thanks for that. We read all our evaluations, and there were some lovely feedback on our Twitter channel. So at Bar Niche Mark. So sorry, Mark, I probably like totally mangled your Twitter handle, who said it was fun and praised it. So that's high praise, especially from you. Thank you, Mark. And a big shout out, very special shout out to at Gamer Learner, who's Colin Simpson on Twitter, who liked the small higher education insights we don't get as professional staff and the bright hangout energy. And he followed this up by featuring us in the Campus Morning, his Campus Morning Mail column.
Oh,
thank you, Colin. There was a big spike in the downloads.
Very nice.
And we did particularly enjoy this review on Twitter from at Villeneuve2020, who says, brilliant podcast about a brilliant mistake. And as a person of colour, women, I loved hearing your wonderful, insightful, hilarious input, nailing the realism of the chair. Can't wait to listen to your next one. Spot on, ladies. 10 out of 10. Thank you for your rate and review.
That's nice.
And now, in our first episode, we expressed our wish to the universe that other people would make their own podcasts. And thank you so much to Dr. Ethel, who runs the Academic Aunties pod. She's at Tungahan. Sorry if I mangled that one as well on Twitter. We'll include it in the show notes. I hadn't seen the Academic Aunties podcast before, and I've been missing out, clearly, because I've now listened to almost every episode.
No, it's really good.
It's really good.
Fantastic. Yeah, awesome.
So it's definitely worth searching out and subscribing. The first episode in season two, which is one she pointed me at, was a podcast about the whole series. So she doesn't, they don't unpack it the leisurely way that we do, but she did do it with two other female academics who also happen to be women of color, Jamie Chai Yun Liu and Kimberly McKee. And listening to it was so fun and so instructive. And I think they picked up on things that I didn't notice. And that's my whiteness showing. So thank you. We'll include the link in the show notes. So if you want to send us notes or feedback or even give us an evaluation, you can do that by leaving us an Apple review. You can email us using the address supplied in the show notes. You can DM one of us on Twitter. And speaking of DMing us and the internet, where can people find you, Megan?
I'm at Megan J. McPherson on Insta and Twitter, where you'll meet my academic cats, Maximum, Dulcie and Mr. Finn.
And we've only seen Maximum in this episode, so the other two are hiding. Thank you. As I said, I'm at Thesis Whisper on Twitter, which is also the name of my blog. What about you, Narelle?
I'm at Relicop on Twitter and Instagram, and also at www.exploreandcreateco.com.
Thanks. And Anitra?
I'm at Anitra Knott on all the things. I also have a website I forgot to mention, anitraland.com, where you can see my book. I don't know if my students have read my book like Bill's students read his book. But
we can live in hope. At least they can find
it. You can look at it on the thing, yeah.
And Pauline, when can people find you on the internet?
I'm at Representing HE on Twitter.
Thank you for that. And thank you, friends. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Ta-ta. Bye.